Good evening. In the news tonight, the trial begins for the NYPD officer who shot and killed Brooklyn native 28-year-old Akai Gurley. The New York City Council holds a hearing on the Criminal Justice Reform Act. Untold numbers of women are facing motherhood and being ostracized after being raped by members of Boko Haram in Nigeria. And entanglements and difficulties are keeping the peace talks from going forward in Syria. With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Monday, January 25th, 2016.
Akai, the pain and suffering that our family have been going through is unbearable.
It's very difficult for the family of Akai Gurley to relive his death, but that's exactly what's happening at Brooklyn Supreme Court. That's where NYPD officer Peter Liang is on trial. He's charged with one count of second-degree manslaughter, one count of criminally negligent homicide, one count of second-degree assault, one count of reckless endangerment, and two counts of official misconduct. He shot and killed Akai Gurley in the stairwell of the Louis Pink NYCHA houses on November 20th, 2014. Officer Liang was patrolling the stairwell with his gun drawn.
Peter Liang, you don't live in public housing, but other people do.
Outside the courthouse, Akai Gurley's cousin Misha Joseph reads a statement from Gurley's mom.
Why would you have your gun out in a place where people travel, where children travel? Why are you scared in a place where people live, scared enough to have your weapon drawn? I've tried to console myself, but I don't know how to start.
The prosecutor, Mark Fleidner, said the NYPD officer recklessly fired his gun into a darkened stairwell and then stood there whining and moaning about how he could get fired instead of helping the dying man. Kirby Joseph, who works with the Justice for Akai Gurley Family Campaign, says inside the courtroom the second witness, Akai Gurley's friend, described what happened after the shooting.
So the witness was the one that actually called 911. Liang and his partner did not do so. Did not have a radio out, did not dispatch for backup or anything like that. It was the witness that did so. And in her doing so, she actually was yelling within the stairwell to Akai's friend, to do CPR. This is how you do it. This is what you should do. She actually got a towel to put pressure on his wounds. And we even found out that Officer Liang walked around the body.
Prosecutors allege that Liang acted recklessly in his handling of the weapon and that he and his partner did nothing to help Gurley, even after they knew he had been shot. Court papers describe the pair walking around the dying victim and down a flight of stairs as the weeping friend tried to give him CPR. Prosecutor Mark Fleidner said neither Liang nor his partner stopped. He said, pointing to Liang, a police officer, this police officer, and he never even knelt down and tried to fix what he'd done. Defense attorney Ray Koshet said that Liang's gun discharged accidentally and that he didn't commit a crime. Peter Liang, she said, had no intent to hurt anyone. She said her client had his gun drawn because he was headed to the roof of the housing project, the most dangerous place of a dangerous place. Nonsense, says Nicholas Hayward Sr. outside the courthouse with his wife Donna Hayward. They say the way that Gurley was killed is the same way that their 13-year-old son, Nicholas Hayward Jr., was shot and killed.
Dimly lit stairwell. The officer was a rookie cop, and they're saying that it was a tragic accident. These are not tragic accidents. These guns do not go off by accident.
So then how come he didn't try to help him? When there's an accident, you try to help the person that's down. You don't walk away and call your superiors to try to cover it up and wait 4 minutes, not even 1 minute. You go to that person that you accidentally shot and try to help them. Period. Point blank. That wasn't no accident.
After listening to testimony, Akai Gurley's aunt, Hortensia Peterson, shared a tearful account of the family's pain.
It's been 1 year and 2 months since your life was stolen. If we could bring you back again for one more hour or day, we'd express all our unspoken love. There's a void in your mother's heart that will never be filled. There's a link missing, an empty seat at the dinner table. Your voice, that infectious smile and laughter will never be seen nor heard. Our family was blessed to have you for such a short time as a son, a cousin, brother, nephew, grandson. Your greatest achievement was being a father. to a beautiful daughter named Mikayla. Okay, the pain and suffering that our family have been going through is unbearable. The pain is still there as it is. It was just a second, a minute, an hour ago. It's so surreal. If we could bring you back again, we say we treasured you and that your presence in our lives meant more than we ever knew.
The trial for Peter Liang and the death of Akai Gurley is expected to last for 2 to 4 weeks. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. The New York City Council held a hearing today on legislation which would reduce the legal consequences of low-level non-criminal violations. Ben Max of Gotham Gazette has been following the story and filed this report.
The package of bills looks to change the way that the city deals with low-level non-violent offenses. These are things like violating park rules, having an open container of alcohol in public, urinating in public, and noise violations. What the city council is trying to do here, they say, is create a more fair, proportional justice system where punishments reflect crimes more closely. A big sticking point in the negotiations has been whether the city changes these violations to only civil violations, where you might get a ticket, something like a parking ticket, or a ticket for having trash outside of your home when it's not a collection day, and removing the criminal violation that corresponds. Commissioner Bratton and Mayor de Blasio have been adamant that the criminal violation must stay on the books. And their rationale behind this is that this gives NYPD officers the ability to A, demand identification and check the background and previous violations of someone they're stopping. City Council Member Vanessa Gibson, who chairs the Public Safety Committee where these bills are being heard and will be passed through, was very clear in saying that all they were doing was creating a different enforcement mechanism, and many city council members have said that they're worried about disproportionate enforcement in communities of color. Representatives from the mayor's office and the NYPD insisted that they have been moving towards a more fair policing of New York City and not an overcriminalization of communities of color. For WBAI, this is Ben Max of Gotham Gazette.
In international news, in Nigeria, there are untold numbers of women who are facing motherhood after being raped by members of Boko Haram. This is according to UN Special Envoy Maud Deber-Bukicio. She says the women are being shunned by society and even their own families.
Their suffering is very deep, and it's also a cultural problem for many of the girls and the women not to be able to speak about what happened to them if it is sexual abuse, which many of them were subjected to. And some of these girls, I mean girls below the age of 18, came to this camp pregnant, impregnated by Boko Haram, gave birth to children who are stigmatized, labeled forever as Boko Haram children. Those who were released or freed from Boko Haram are still, by many communities and even by their families, considered as having sided with Boko Haram, and they are simply not accepted.
The UN envoy says what the Nigerian women need most is to turn to someone they can trust.
Somebody who understands. There's an obvious need for a professional who are really capable of allowing these victims to speak out. I had one moment of eye contact with one of the victims, and that's when I told her that it was not her fault. She couldn't be blamed, and she was so grateful for that. You know, and that's the kind of thing which the professionals can do or need to do. But there's the problem is so immense. There's need for training of professionals who have the ability to allow these girls to speak. So can you imagine how terrible that is for the women? And again, as I said, I mean, they are being shunned by society, by their own family. And what will be the future of these children? So this is really a top priority.
Meanwhile, 4 suicide bombers attacked a market and town today in Cameroon's far north region near the border with Nigeria. Officials say they killed at least 35 people and wounded 65 others. They are blaming Boko Haram for the attack, saying the assailants crossed over from Nigeria. Suicide bombers have killed dozens in the region in the past month. Boko Haram joined the Islamic State group in March. On Monday, the IS-linked AMAC news agency posted a message reporting suicide bombings in northern Cameroon. This is according to Site Intelligence Groups, which monitors jihadi websites. The message said the attacks on the village-targeted gatherings of the militia allied with the army operating on the border with Nigeria. Boko Haram's six-year insurgency has killed about 20,000 people and displaced 2.3 million. This is according to Amnesty International and the UN. In other news, the United Nations said today that it would issue invitations for marathon Syrian peace talks to begin this week. Opposition groups, though, signaled they would stay away unless the government and its Russian allies halt the airstrikes and lift sieges on towns. The first talks in 2 years to end the Syrian civil war were meant to begin today, but they've been held up in part by a dispute over who should represent the opposition to President Bashar al-Assad. UN envoy Staffan de Mistura said he's working on the list, and he expects to issue the invitations tomorrow for talks which begin on Friday. Deanne Penn reports.
Geneva has hosted two previous rounds of international talks on the Syrian conflict in 2012 and 2014. Mr. de Mistura said the delayed start this time was due to intense disagreements over who should be at the negotiating table.
We are going to aim at proximity talks, starting on the 29th and ongoing for 6 months on a staggered chronological proximity approach. That will be the way we try to make it different from the past. This is not Geneva III. This is leading to what we hope will be a Geneva success story if we are able to push it forward.
The UN Security Council has urged the envoy to include the broadest possible spectrum of the Syrian opposition. Initially, the parties to the conflict will not hold face-to-face meetings. Mr. de Mistura said invitations will be sent out on Tuesday.
The invitations will clearly want to be also addressed to women and civil society. I've made a point, and the Secretary General has been extremely clear on that. Whatever list of various delegations want to come, we will make sure that there is a substantial presence of women to advise me and make sure that we are in the right position regarding the future of Syria, of which there are 51% at least of them.
The talks will center on a Security Council resolution that lays out a roadmap for peace in Syria. Resolution 2254, which was passed last month, focuses on new governance, a new constitution, and elections.
There are political risks, but those political risks and tensions and positioning and prepositioning should be also taken into account that our line is, and the Security Council has been clear, no preconditions, at least to start the talks and while the talks start.
The Syrian crisis is entering its sixth year with more than 250,000 people killed and over 13 million citizens requiring humanitarian aid. It has also had a ripple effect in neighboring countries such as Lebanon, who have taken in millions of refugees, and also in Europe, with countless Syrians continuing to risk their lives on dangerous sea journeys to reach safety. Mr. de Mistura hopes the talks will bring about what he sees as the first priority for all Syrians, a broad ceasefire which would allow for increased humanitarian aid delivery. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
In other local news, there's a new law to give grocery store workers more job security, but it's drawing opponents in the grocery industry. Nia Hamm reports.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is expected to sign a new bill protecting supermarket workers. The Grocery Worker Retention Act requires new owners of large grocery stores to keep workers employed for 90 days. It follows last year's closing of A&P Supermarkets, which had 52 stores in the city when it filed for bankruptcy. Meg Fosk of the immigration advocacy group Make the Road New York says the bill gives grocery workers, most of them immigrants, a bit more peace of mind.
Of course, undocumented workers are more vulnerable in a lot of ways. But when it comes to this issue, really everybody's in the same boat in terms of a new employer currently being able to come in and fire everybody. This protects all workers, at least giving them a period of transition and job security.
The bill passed with 7 no votes, a high number for the city council, which often passes bills that make it to the floor with little, if any, dissent. Jay Peltz of the Food Industry Alliance says many in the grocery industry also oppose the law and see it as an overreach of government.
there's no reason to single out our industry. And over the long run, the market is much more efficient in terms of allocating jobs than government. So the best way to maximize employment is by letting the market do it.
Peltz says he worries the bill will become precedent for similar laws in other parts of the state. But its supporters, such as Councilmember Brad Lander, point out that the city already has a worker retention law in place for building service workers. For New York News Connection, I'm Mia Hamm.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Monday, January 25th, 2016. The news was produced with help from Deanne Penn at the United Nations, Ben Max of Gotham Gazette, Nia Hamm with the New York News Connection, Reggie Johnson at WBAI's Brooklyn Studios. For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Thanks for listening.